Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer, and I am back from a week of traveling. To stop this from being a monologue, which I hate, I've invited my esteemed colleague, Jason Cochran, on. He is going to grill me about this recent trip I took. Hey, Jason, are you ready for the, what is it called, beyond a grilling?
How about a download? I don't want to grill you. I've got my big cup of coffee here. And okay. I'm curious to hear all about this amazing trip that you just squeezed in just about a week. And I'm sure, you, as you always do when you come back on these trips, you're going to have more than a week's worth of experiences to tell us about.
Well, yeah, that's an accusation my husband lobs at me. He thinks he calls me the Energizer Bunny because they always get much more tired than I do. And they go back to the hotel and I keep running around and seeing things. This trip was kind of a surprise. My college daughter, the younger one, said out of the blue that none of her friends could decide on where to go for spring break together. And mom and dad, do you want to go somewhere with me? And since we always assume this will be the last time she ever asks that, we jumped at it. And we said, yeah, let's do it. And
so, well, I just want to say, you know, you already started this with a lottery win. A daughter in college wants to spend spring break with her parents. That's setting the stage for this trip. It's already amazing.
Yeah. No, that was a big surprise and really nice. And so we've been talking for a long time about going to Italy. My husband spent a semester in college in Rome, so he speaks some Italian. We have a bunch of plates that we got from Deruta, Italy, which is one of the top ceramics manufacturing places in all of Europe. And we got them, 18 years ago, and they're on their last legs. And so we thought, let's go back to Italy and get some more plates, which is...
I think that's a terrific excuse for travel. I'm not even laughing. I just think it's amazing that you thought of it, because how many things in our lives could we say, oh, let's go to Florence and pick up some more? I think it's fantastic.
But we were going to, I've always wanted to really concentrate on the South, which is something I haven't done before. And I also, you know, coming out of this pandemic, before the pandemic, I had something in my mind that said, you like hard travel. You like travel to places like India and sub-Saharan Africa and other places where you really have to struggle with the basics, where it's, you know, difficult to get yourself understood. It's difficult to get from place A to place B, where it's challenging. Coming out of the pandemic, I just wanted to relax on the road and go to places where you're going to eat incredibly well and meet lovely people and see beautiful things and not have to work that hard. After this trip, I actually think I'm back to wanting to do something a little harder, but it still was wonderful.
Well, now your trip didn't go that smoothly, I happen to know.
That's true. Yes. Right before we left, we were leaving on a Friday. That Monday, my husband calls me and says, Lufthansa just emailed that the trip is canceled. There are strikes in Germany. And I thought, how can that be? Because I looked at the schedule for the strikes and they were supposed to end the night before we flew there. But that also meant that the plane couldn't come get us from Germany. So after many, many hours on hold with Lufthansa, the first time I talked to them, they said, sorry, you can't cancel the first part of the flight. You have to take the whole thing and it's not canceled. You got wrong information from us. Then the second time I called back, they said, oh no, we were correct. It is canceled and we will allow you to take just the second half of the trip. So then I had to scramble. Part of the problem with traveling in off season to Italy is in high season, there are direct flights from the US to Naples. There are not in off season. And since I wanted to go pretty far south, that meant I had to go through another destination, and my two choices were either through Turkey, which would have been a 13-hour flight there, which was nuts, and then like a 7-hour layover in the airport, or through Germany, or then I found one on French B Airlines, which I will write up for fromers.com. Long story short, French B is the Frontier Airlines of transatlantic travel.
And that does not sound like much of a compliment.
No, it's not a compliment. I mean, thin seats where you can feel every bit of the metal underlying the cushioning, flight attendants in denim uniforms. they still had the natty, you know, a scarf around their necks, but they were all in denim. I was like, denim? Really? They were very nice. They were fine. And it was like sauna-like hot on the plane. I don't know why, but it was a very strange flight. My husband wasn't able to sleep at all. I slept a little bit. And then from that, we had to do EasyJet in the Orly airport. Yeah, so, you know, EasyJet turned out to be fine, actually. That was fine.
But it has lots of rules, right? You have to follow. Like, you pay for this ahead of time.
Luckily, I remembered, like, if you don't print out your boarding pass or... Actually, now I think you can actually have it downloaded, but I got so nervous I printed it out because it used to be they would charge you like 50 euros to print you a boarding pass. I mean, they'll charge you for every single thing they can on EasyJet. So getting there wasn't easy, but then we were in Naples.
And I know you love Naples. You have a lot of good things to say.
I hadn't been there in about a decade, and it really has changed. A decade ago, it felt like a hidden secret. It felt like this beautiful ancient city. Naples got the name from the Greeks. It was Neapolis, or New City, back when the Greeks founded it in something BC. I don't have that in front of me. And it's on hills, and it's very rough and tumble, or it was 10 years ago. And nobody went to Naples 10 years ago. It was considered too dangerous. Now... it felt like Tourist Central. It just was a party scene when we got there. It might be that it was in the week leading up to Easter. So our first night there, we were walking across half the city to a pizzeria we wanted to try. You got to have pizza in Naples. That's where it was created. And suddenly there were processions passing us by because local churches in the run-up to Easter parade around their saints and with major bands and people in costume and ask for money to raise money for their churches. And so it just felt like the best street party. When I went a decade ago, it was quiet on the streets. People were warning us not to go there. And now it felt flipped. Now it felt like a major Italian city rather than a backwater.
Maybe those flights won't be seasonal for long.
Maybe not. Maybe not. And so for our first day, we did a food tour, which was a lot of fun. Tried the pastries and the espresso, and he told us about the history of Naples, where he was a proud Neapolitan. Our guide, Aldo Rock, was his name. And I mentioned Garibaldi, and he almost spit on the ground. You know, in the south of Italy, Garibaldi is a villain because they feel in joining the country together from all of these different states, which is what Garibaldi did in the 19th century. He made the south a secondary player. Kingdom of Naples had been rich and powerful until unification, and then it just went down the toilets. And so they blame Garibaldi about that.
Well, when you were away, I watched a couple of Visconti movies. One of them is Rocco and His Brothers, which takes place in Naples pretty much in the 40s and 50s, sort of as a knock-on of all those people from the South having to move to Naples because things in the South went so badly. They moved to Naples, and Rocco and His Brothers, and basically survived by surviving in the projects. Rocco and His Brothers is a great old movie with Alain Delon, and The Leopard, which is about the rise of Garibaldi and how that changed everything for the nobles. So I watched both of those movies when you were away. So I have a little bit of perspective on what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And then we went into this area called the Spanish Quarter, which is what you probably think Naples looks like. It's this area where the streets are maybe the width of a large sofa. So, you know, these towering buildings, these maze-like streets. And he told us about these. It was absolutely fascinating. In the 1700s, I didn't realize this, Vesuvius erupted again. didn't only erupt at the time it buried Pompeii back in the Roman era. It erupted then, and also the plague hit the city at the same time. And so it was part of the Bourbon Empire at that point. A lot of different entities ruled Naples over the years. And so the Bourbon Emperor at that point, or the king, was Spanish. So he sent in Spanish troops. He built these maze-like warrens of streets in which a lot of the bedrooms were on the first floor because soldiers were sleeping in them. And then when the soldiers left, the Camorra, the mafia, moved into this area because it was a really easy area to hide in because you couldn't find your way through these streets. And, you know, there's laundry hanging above. And at one point, he pointed to a window and he said, "Look in the window, you'll see Madame so-and-so. She used to be a prostitute, and that's why her bedroom's on the first floor." And we look in the window and there's this 80-year-old woman, and she waves to us.
Well, and, she's friendly.
Yeah, and Aldo said, "People don't care about privacy here in Naples. We live in public." And he pointed out in front of a building across the street, there was this light blue hanging kind of teddy bear-like thing. And he said, "See, nobody cares about privacy. They're announcing they had a boy, a baby boy, a month ago. You know, the whole neighborhood needs to know." And then we wandered into this kind of makeshift restaurant where we sat down and they fed us more pastries and coffee. And he said, "You don't even need a license to open a restaurant in Naples. Isn't that great? Anybody can do it." So this old couple, they're very friendly, and they decided a couple of years ago, and I like to support them. And they were lovely. And so
this was on your food tour.
This was on the food tour, which was a lot of fun.
Do you want to give a shout out to who provided the food tour, or how did you go about finding this outfit that you went with?
I went through, we have a good one mentioned in fromers.com. We decided to go with this private guide because he came highly recommended by a friend. His name is Aldo Rock. He's a delightful man. You know, he said at the end of the tour, "I hope my love of Florence came shining through," and boy, did it. He just Naples, yes. He just made us
feel. My love for Florence is eternal. My love for Naples needs to be developed like yours.
Right. Yeah. He just made it all come alive. There was wine on the tour, so that knocked out my husband and daughter. So they went back to the hotel to sleep, and I went to the cathedral, which I hadn't been to before. And it's an incredible time to go because the baptistry there has finally reopened after literally decades of renovation. It's this baptistry from the year 500 AD. It's one of the oldest surviving buildings in Europe, or surviving religious buildings, with these extraordinary murals on the domed ceilings and on the walls, and it just takes you back in time. So I went there. I went to another museum, which was sold out, and was sold out for an entire week. I actually alerted our guidebook author because we were there in what is supposed to be low season. So for something like that to sell out was really, really surprising. But it didn't feel like low season in Naples. It did in the next place we went to. So the next day we picked up our rental car and we drove to the third oldest city on the planet. It is called Matera. And it has been inhabited since Neolithic times because it's this area of tufa caves and rocks, and they're very easy to cut into. It's a soft stone. And so people lived both in the caves, and then they would excavate the caves for rocks and build buildings on top of those. And it's one of the most, you know, that artistic movement from the 50s, cubism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like cubism come to life. That's what this city looks like. It's just this incredible melange of shapes bumped up next to one another. And when you look at it from, it's in a valley, so you can often see it from above. And it's all these ancient rocks. It looks as ancient as it is. In fact, Mel Gibson made his movie, The Passion of the Christ, there because he felt it looked more like Jerusalem than Jerusalem does. But there's a tragic, tragic history in Matera. In the Carlo Levi was a major Italian intellectual. He was a doctor, he was an essayist, and he was an anti-fascist. And so Mussolini imprisoned him near to Matera. And then his brother came to visit him there and saw Matera and said to Carlo Levi, when you get out, you have to see this place. It's incredible. They're living in caves. It's like you've gone back several centuries. You've got to see this place. And so when Carlo Levi was finally released, he did go to Matera and wrote a book called, I want to say, Christ Stops at Eboli, which was this muckraking piece of journalism that showed the entire world that in the heart of Italy, there were people living as if it was the fifth century, that they were living in these caves with livestock in the caves with them, with no running water, with no electricity, hand-to-mouth subsistence society. And the Italian government was so embarrassed by what Carlo Levi wrote that they decided, okay, we have to forcefully move these people. And so they brought in a group of architects from all over the world to build them new housing on the outskirts of the city. And they started moving them in the early 60s. And a lot of these people had to be forced, you know, that they had real communities in Matera.
Sure, lived, going back centuries. I mean,
going back centuries. Yeah. And they had a whole economy that was based on communalism. Everybody, they would get a certain amount of food and water, and it would be shared among different families. And so they were moved forcibly without any look at where the communities in Matera were. So they were just moved randomly into these modern buildings.
Sounds a lot like what we did in the 50s here in this country when we built the interstates.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of these people didn't even know how to use a light switch. And so another problem was they moved them out of their long-term cave homes and never kept records of who lived where. So several decades passed. It was a very fraught time. Certain people appreciated the move and felt like it allowed their children to be better educated, allowed them to get different types of jobs than would have been available. Other people only wanted to return to the traditional way of life. And in the 90s, people started moving back into the ancient cave city.
This time, I imagine they're updating the caves with maybe electricity and things like that.
Yes, and they were only allowing people to move back who had the means to update the caves.
Right. And so sanitation, all that stuff.
Plumbing, sanitation, electricity.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the caves went to multinational organizations, hotels, major, you know, now you have major luxury hotels in these caves. I actually stayed in a cave apartment, which the guy told us had been owned by his grandparents. And in the cave was a lot of his grandmother's furnishings. So a little cradle that rocked back and forth was in our bedroom. And we were sleeping on this old, I had a new mattress. It was very comfortable, but an old wireframe bed. But it was a really stunning, fascinating place to visit with some very good museums, caves painted in different styles and decorated in different styles because there was an era when Byzantine monks fled from, I want to say, Albania to Matera and set up communities there. So you have some of the churches done in a Byzantine style, which is really surprising. And these are churches carved out of caves, which also makes them really unique and fascinating to see. So just a really extraordinary place to go. Half of the places we had looked at in advance to eat at were not yet open, but that, you know, that
was. They have a season there too?
They have a season there too. Our best meal was at this really great little restaurant. I can't remember the name. I'll put it up on fromers.com. And we were there the night they were reopening for the season. So we were there with two other tables at this massive restaurant, you know, with a full staff waiting on three tables. But it was really, really great food, fascinating.
Yeah, what is the food like? But now we have such a distinct and ancient area of Italy kind of kicked around by the rest of Italian society and ignored or forgotten or not even, you know, not even realized they're there. How does that develop into something distinct in the character of the people and the food?
Well, the South, talk to any Southerners about their cuisine and about their food, and they will say it's better than in the North because in the North right now, a lot of the food they're eating is being imported in from all over the world. Whereas in the South, because the economy isn't as strong, they're still just eating what the local farms provide. And so the food is very seasonal, but extraordinarily fresh, very delicious, wonderful wines. And for the most part, we ate very well. I mean,
does the food differ very much from the rest of Italy in terms of what you get on the plate? Is it pasta? Is it meats? What kind of stuff do they like to eat there?
Oh, it's pastas. It's fish. It's meats. You know, it's
Is it sort of Mediterranean?
Yeah, you're never too far from the seacoast there. So a lot of fish dishes, a lot of pizza. They're very proud of their pizza in the South, and it's delicious.
Is it much different from the kind of pizza you would get in Naples?
No, I didn't find it to be. I mean, I was told that the pizza on the Amalfi Coast had a thicker crust. Yes, you know, slightly. I don't know.
Right.
But it was very good food. It was very good food. So then
eating pizza and living in a cave sounds like my idea of a vacation. That's terrific.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really lovely. And then we decided to drive from Matera to the Amalfi Coast, which is somewhere I hadn't been since I was a child. And everybody I know said, go to Ravello, because Ravello is less touristy, less honky-tonk, less crowded than the other towns on the Amalfi Coast. That's great advice for high season. But in low season, that meant that the town of Ravello had exactly one restaurant that was open in this entire town. We kept wandering the first night thinking, where are we going to eat? We finally came to this restaurant, and the guy told me it would be an hour-long wait. And I said, can you recommend another place to go that, you know, nearby that would be better? He said, we're the only restaurant that's open right now.
Yeah. Okay. So now when you say low season, what is considered low season in this part of the world?
I think shoulder season starts around the end of March. So low season.
So you have more than one choice after April, or starting in April, you have more than one restaurant to choose from.
Yeah. Three quarters of the hotels in Ravello were closed. I mean, it really was shut down pretty tight, which was nice because, you know, when we were wandering around the square, only Italians are there. And when we went into a plate shop, and we did go into a plate shop and we bought some lovely bowls to replace the ones that were broken, they said because it's off season, they would give us free shipping. So...
Now, you said something else that made me think. You took a car from Naples to Matera and then to the Amalfi Coast.
Yes.
Neither of those places are really great to drive cars into, are they? What did you have to park outside of the town? How did it work?
Oh, yeah. Well, the guy who owned the apartment we stayed in Matera, he said, you're going to park in my father's parking space outside this high-rise apartment building. And then he picked us up and he had a special license to drive into town. And then we just walked for 2 days.
Oh, so some of them have special licenses. So these are things you need to plan for when you have a vacation. You can't just get a rental car and drive in them into Matera. You sort of have to have a game plan. Yeah.
Right. You have to have a game plan. And then they picked us up and drove us out. And then we drove from Matera to the Amalfi Coast through an area that looked like Colorado or Utah. Just these extraordinary mountains and buttes and beautiful scenery. I really wasn't expecting that. And then we got to the Amalfi Coast, and it's always the advice not to drive the Amalfi Coast. Now I know why. I think it was the scariest driving I've ever witnessed. My husband's a real showboat when it comes to driving. He thinks of himself as a good driver. And I guess the fact that I'm still alive proves he's right. because it's these windy roads that really are only big enough for one car, but somehow there's two lanes. There's no room for error. And every turn feels almost like a U-turn. I mean, you're not just doing twisty roads. You're doing full U shapes. Everything's in the shape of a W along that road. And then suddenly a bus comes along and everybody has to stop and sometimes even back up so that the bus can make a wide turn. And on one side...
It's a good
side
thing you got that rest at the hotel.
Oh, yeah. Well, on one side, there's a sheer drop down into the ocean hundreds of feet below. On the other side, there's rocky cliffs. I mean, it was really...
want to do that, and I mean, most people probably don't, can you take a train to the Amalfi Coast? How do you get there if you don't feel like driving yourself?
If you don't feel like driving, what a lot of people do is either they take the public bus. And once we parked outside of Ravello, once this is another place where we couldn't drive into the heart of the town, we had to park in a parking lot and then drag our suitcases to our apartment. Once we did that, we took the public bus everywhere. But you can also get around by ferries. And that's what a lot of people do. So they avoid the roads altogether, which really, I mean, they were scarier than any roller coaster I've ever been on. It's incredible to me that people survive these daily, because there was not an inch.
Yeah. You know this, of course, the more you travel, the more you ride roads like that. I remember roads in Nepal where you're on a bus full of 70 people and another bus comes the other way and there's only one lane and you're convinced this is the end of your life. But they're so used to doing it that usually they don't crash.
right, yeah. So we spent a couple of days in Ravello. The downside of being in Ravello in off season is the major thing you want to do there is visit the gardens. And so we mostly saw gardeners planting the shoots that were going to be absolutely gorgeous for people who came there in a month or two. And the whole area is blanketed by lemon trees, but because it was still hail season, all of the lemon trees were wrapped in this kind of very thick black or green netting. So, you know, that wasn't as beautiful as it could have been. But we were staying in a two-bedroom apartment that in high season would have cost $300 to $400 a night, and we got it for about $100.
Do you feel like the negatives of staying in off season, you know, fewer choices and places to go, things like that, were offset by the lower prices and sort of the freedom of being able to do whatever you wanted otherwise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, all of the attractions were open. If the attractions had been closed, that would have been a bummer because, you know, you want to see what you've come to see. But the fact that we had fewer restaurants to choose from, that didn't feel like such a big thing. And it meant we didn't have crowds. I mean, And we also got to do things. We did this hike from Ravello, which is at the top of a cliff, down to Minori, which is at the base of the cliff. And I read on the internet after we decided to do this, people were saying, you have to be a major athlete to do this. It's crazy. Bring water, bring sunscreen. It's insanely difficult. Well, it is difficult in the heat of summer. It was a charming walk, you know, the rest of this time of year. And it was fun because we only met Italians coming up and down this walk. In fact, we met a guy riding a donkey to which it was attached another donkey and another donkey and another donkey, all loaded down with goods, because to get to these towns up and down this cliffside path, the only way to get to a lot of these places was by donkey. So even today, so that was an eye-opener.
Part of Italy sounds really interesting. Now, if people haven't pictured where this is in their heads, Matera is kind of like in the middle between the boot and the toe of Italy. It goes up just a little bit and that it's in there. And Amalfi Coast is just south of Naples on the west coast of the main part of Italy, right?
Right. And the Amalfi Coast, I think, is the place in season where the millionaires go. It's all about yachting. It's about scuba diving. It's about gorgeous vistas and very gourmet food. We probably had our best food, with the exception of the restaurant we went to in Matera, on the Amalfi Coast. I mean, everything was splendid and not too expensive. You know, you get a coffee, a cafe for €1.50. You get we had pizza for €5, an entire pie, you know? So it wasn't pricey in the south because the economy
was... It cold
there,
at all? You said it hailed a little bit. What was the temperature like? How'd you have to dress?
We actually didn't experience hail, thank goodness. That we had a little bit of rain It was in the 50s and 60s, so I had a light jacket on, but everybody in the South, the Southern Italians, who I guess are more warm-blooded, they all had these huge puffer coats on and big hats.
Yeah.
They were dressed for snow.
Very windy?
No, not too windy. Not too windy.
I know in the off-season of Greece, which of course is not right next to Italy, but that gets super windy in the wintertime and people don't want to be there. But those are islands.
Yeah.
Off-season means so many different things depending on where you are. It can be inhospitable or going to just be a little chilly so people don't want to come. And it sounds like it was the latter for here.
It was just a little chilly. And for us, that was great because I know nowadays Naples and the whole south of Italy gets excruciatingly hot. And so I took this trip thinking that maybe off-season had shifted a little bit in response to climate change. But it hasn't yet, I don't think. I think it will in further years. I think more people will do what we did. And so for the very final day, we did the most touristy thing we could do. But we had the kid with us. It's not touristy. We went to Herculaneum. You've probably heard of Pompeii. Pompeii was the city that was tragically covered by ash when Mount Vesuvius erupted in... what was it, AD 70 or something like that?
79 or something like that, yeah.
79. And so this entire city was covered up and forgotten and then excavated starting in the 18th century. Herculaneum was a small seaside resort town. It was a place where rich Romans went to have their seaside vacations. And it was covered, it got destroyed in a different way because it was closer to the volcano. So it had, first of all, this river of gases and ash hit the people there first and killed them instantly. The temperature went up by 200 degrees within 1 minute. And so people just melted, literally, unlike in Pompeii, where they had maybe 30 or 40 seconds of smothering to death. So it was a much faster death. And then lava covered Herculaneum, which meant that a lot of things that were not preserved in Pompeii were preserved in Herculaneum.
Encased in rock so they could be discovered again one day.
Encased in rock so no bacteria got in.
Yeah.
And so you see the actual wood that was in structures. You see beds that were made of wood that somehow got saved, and these extraordinary houses. And you remember, you know, in the Middle Ages, people were living without indoor plumbing, but the Romans had that. And in Herculaneum, all of the houses had toilets and indoor plumbing. And you see the toilets today, and you see. And apparently it was being built in Pompeii. They were building the sewer system when Vesuvius erupted. And so it never was finished. And our guide told us that when it rains heavily in Pompeii, the ruins get flooded. But in Herculaneum, because of the sewer system, to this day, Roman engineering keeps that city from being flooded, which I just thought was
incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah, and also when you just think that you were just in Matera, where they never got that stuff until recently.
Italy is
so many stories happening in such a small space.
Yes, very true. So we did that tour. It was called Italy with an Archaeologist. I think I found it through Get Your Guide. Our tour guide was probably an auctioneer in another life. I've never heard anybody speak as fast. But once I tuned into it, and he had so much to say that in the two-hour tour, he packed in a hell of a lot. It was a great, great tour. It really was absolutely fascinating.
Well, I know, having been to both Pompeii now and Herculaneum, if someone had to choose one, which one should they choose?
I think Herculaneum, because Pompeii is vast. It was a city. This was a little resort town. And only a quarter of it is open to the public. The rest of it is still buried and is under modern housing. The only reason we have this quarter of the city is that the fascists, Mussolini, said, I want to uncover this. Everybody who lives there has to move. And so he displaced a lot of people to dig up these ruins. But that means that in 2 hours, you actually can see the whole thing. and get a really good picture and idea of what life was like there. And they have a museum with some fascinating, heart-wrenching things. They have the jewelry that they found on the skeletons of people standing in the harbor about to get on boats. But because the temperature went up so abruptly, very few people escaped from Herculaneum. So it was a really, really wonderful day. And so from Herculaneum, we went to Sorrento for our very last night. And we decided to have a blowout dinner, which was probably our most disappointing dinner in Italy. The night we decided to spend a lot of money was the night we had the worst food. But, you know, it still was fun. It was fun being there with my daughter and drinking limoncello with her. She just turned 21. So even though in Italy, I think you only have to be 18 to drink, but she's still high on being 21, you know.
I think limoncello was this great way to go in. Limoncello is such a fun drink.
Well, she insisted
it's,
on
it's trying, Italian too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And she insisted on trying grappa too, which tastes like
we all try it at least once.
Yes.
And you know, grappa, it takes many forms in many countries, that anise flavor. So
is it better in other countries? Because it was
ouzu and is it more Greek and Turkish? I think if you like that flavor, it's great everywhere, but I'm not a big fan of that flavor.
Oof, no, it's really tough. So anyway, so a wonderful trip. I can't wait for my next one back to Italy. It was interesting, in the last 2 years, I've done a lot of trips to France, and I love France. It's a beautiful country, but the Italians really make you feel much more welcomed than sometimes you get in France. I think, I don't want to be cliched about this, but I think in France, it's more culturally acceptable to be really grumpy, whereas I think that's looked down on more in Italy, or maybe they're just sunnier. I don't know. But
it's two people who have lived in Manhattan. I think we can identify with that. You're just really busy. It's not necessarily you don't like everybody. You just got stuff you're doing, and so it comes across as grumpy.
Yeah,
it's French to me.
Yeah. It's French. Yes, very French. Yeah. What a trip. It was great. I'm sad to be back, but happy to be talking to you about it.
Yeah, and off season, I'm so happy to hear that it worked out and you didn't run into major roadblocks. And it sounds like you saved a fair bit of money doing an off season too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we probably spent a third of what we would have on lodgings to get around. I don't know if it translated in terms of the rental car costs. I think it probably did. And we got free shipping on the plates, the reason we went there. So.
And they haven't arrived yet, though, have they?
No. Oh, yeah. God.
Fingers crossed.
I'm worried they won't.
You just have to go back. Go get some more.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me, Jason. And thank you all for listening. Let me say that if you're hearing this and you're living in Dallas, in the afternoon, I will be speaking at the Dallas Travel and Adventure Show. That's the last Travel and Adventure Show for the season. So I hope you'll come out and say hello.
On the 24th, we're talking, right?
Yeah. March 24th. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage. I'll see you next week.
Lazy afternoons in your sweatpants, watching cable.